You know, no filtration process. You know what I mean? Your kid could be 12 and can see, you know what I'm saying, a lot of his mother's, a lot of his friends' mothers naked on the internet. Yeah. Like, this is wild. So, yeah, man, it's just, it's one big toxic cocktail. Yeah. It really is.
So which neighborhood were you born in?
I was born in North Philly.
Okay. So can you tell us a bit about your story? And we know that you were charged with attempted murder at one point.
At one point.
Now, tomorrow you're meeting with the president.
Yes.
What's that journey?
So I don't know. I was born and raised in North Philly. So like, that's one of my passions, you know, for what I do.
But a Cowboys fan.
Yeah, absolutely. So some people may stop listening in the moment you said
that. Yeah, I'm
so
sorry. So, cut so, that, yeah.
So with that being said, I mean, my real father was in and out of jail my whole life. So I don't know him, don't have a relationship with him. You know, literally when people say that they become a product of their environment, you know, I literally succumbed to my environment. I became that same thing. Kids that I grew up playing in the street with, playing football with, like, which we never see now because it's not even safe to. And then everybody has phones and iPads and Call of Duty. So like, people don't want to go outside. But, you know, the guys I grew up, man, playing sports with, ended up taking their own turns of life, you know, and some of their parents were addicted to drugs and everything else. Like, they had to provide, literally, you know. My mother and her husband did the best they could, obviously. And, you know, at some point, though, my friends were my brothers. So I kind of took on their burdens. And, you know, at a young age, I made choices, you know, to really support my friends and become part of my environment. And I won't blame my parents, anybody, for that. But, you know, had a son at 18. You know, I kind of basically, like, my mom had me at 19. Like, so a lot of these cycles, you know, that we've seen in our environments, man, I became that. And so was running the streets, still working jobs, bivocational, you know, drug dealer at the time. again, you know, walking down that path, and lo and behold, at, I want to say 23, I got arrested for attempted murder. Was out on bail, had a disagreement with someone over money, and one thing led to another. The man said that I tried to rob him. So that's just what that was. So I went back to jail, like, within a month and a half apart from each other. $500,000 bail. Wasn't no getting out this time. Wow. And, you know, but I met a reverend before I had actually went to jail. I was going to church. So it's one of those people walking on two sides of the street. You know, I just felt like, man, this thing feels good. Like, it's always, I mean, listening to it makes, you know, makes sense. It's like they're talking to me. And this was a lot of people's experience when they go in church. And, you know, sitting all the way up top in the back. And it was just like, yo, I don't even belong here. So, like, I'm going to sit all the way up top. And, you know, he did this thing with his hands, like, man, pointed up. And I'm just like, this guy wants to talk to me. So he was a younger pastor at the time. He's like the assistant pastor. And talked to him after church. And he was just like, yo, I want to talk to you, man. Can I get your number? And he was just like, you know, I want to share some things God shared with me about you. So I'm just like, this guy's talking about God. Talk to him about me. I'm like, yo, all right, he's crazy. But I couldn't say no. It's like, I wanted to come back the next week. Gave him my number. And he eventually called and was just like, yo, man, God has a call on your life. He was like, man, young people, like, churches set up for two people, probably older crowd and just the children. He was like, man, I'm telling you, he's like, I feel like God really wants you to help me start something for young adults.
Did he know who you were?
No.
Did he just looked at you and just thought?
Man, listen, I don't know what happened, but I didn't even know him. Cause like I told you, I sat all the way up top, plenty of people in church and, you know.
What did your friends think when you got into religion?
Oh man, it was crazy because, you know, they laughed, but not laughed at me for going to church. It was just like, yo, I'm coming back to the block and I'm telling them like, yo, man, y'all should come to church, man. Church was crazy. And you know, but like, this is before like even entering ministry or anything. So it was just like, yo, they was like, yo, you crazy, man. You was just at church today. You back out here with us. And I'm like, look, man, I'm telling you, yo, it was crazy. So, so he says like, I want you to get on this journey with me. And he was like, I want to help disciple you and everything else. And he's like, yeah, but God's calling you to, you know, really help, you know, build these young folk up, these young adults. And like in my mind, I was just laughing because I'm like, dude, I got a gun in the car and this dude is talking about, you know. So, man, I ended up getting locked up about 6 to 9 months after that. That's when I got locked up. So now, but I still was journeying with him, you know what I mean? But it was like a tug on my heart because it was like he'd had me around like young Christian people. And then it was like, I'm going back in my environment, but I'm like, wow, I don't have to worry about like taking the back way home because somebody might follow me home. Like I don't have to worry about like I can let my, I don't have hair, but I can let my hair down and chill, you know, and not have to worry or think twice about these folks. Like that's cool. You know what I'm saying?
So I mean, when you did this, were you like, first of all, how long were you in prison?
I sat for 13 months.
13 months. Mm-hmm. And were you praying, reading the Bible?
Absolutely.
What was that period like?
So yeah, that was the thing. I went inside and I told God straight up, like, look, man, I came in here a Christian, I'm leaving one. And I was just like, you know, that's what it is. My reverend said, like, yo, I'm not upset with you. Like, I'm not giving up. I know what God called you to. That's what he tells me. And, you know, like, I don't know if y'all know, but like Philly culture, especially in the streets, a lot of folks typically like convert to Islam and like, you know what I mean, like urban inner city culture here.
Is that new? How long has that been around?
That's probably been the last, not new, but it's probably been around like the last 30 years, I'll say. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, a lot of people go in there, you know, prison protection, all kinds of other things. But like, you know, it was the thing to do for people. But I went in and it was like, yo, I've been a Christian out here. I'm going in and I'm coming back out one. Like, I don't care what anybody say or whatever. Like, you know. And so going inside, yeah, man, like the craziest experience for me was getting in there. And after you come out of quarantine, like after they test you and everything else and make sure they can get you to put you in general population, I'm like, yo, you go to church. Can you go to church in here? And the guy was like, yo, they got church every day. In the county jail, they got church every day. I was like, every day? So, man, went to church and it was like mind-blowing experience because it was like I went in there like for what they call drama, because like if you got violent crimes and all that, they'll put you on a drama block. So I'm on a drama block with everybody that got, you know, you fighting something serious because our custody level's high. So like everybody has violent crimes. But I'm going in, I go into church and I'm just seeing everybody in, you know, the county uniform and people in there praising God. I'm like, yo, this is heavy. So like greatest church experience I had was that one till this day. And I've been a lot of churches.
Wow.
Till this day.
Wow.
Till this day.
What should people know about being in prison that they don't know?
Oh man, it's probably one of the most dehumanizing experiences of your life, you know? And that was one of the things that honestly, like the thing outside of my faith, right? Cause I stayed in there, ended up teaching Bible study on the block, you know, working. I was in there, I was 22 and I had kids 18 that never been out of the city before. And I'm talking about, they literally still acted like children. And that was one of the things that really grieved me in there. Was like, y'all never got a chance to be kids. I'm talking about wanting to play basketball, argue over sports every day. And I'm like, yo, y'all still 13 in the mind, but you was growing up too fast. Fighting murders, offered deals offered for 40 to 60 years. Cried with me in cells. And I mean, again, these kids were taught though to be tough guys outside. So, you know, but to your point, in there, I've got to see the humanity of people. Like understanding, like, you know, that these people have souls, you know, a lot of people, it was a lot of wrong turns. There was a lot of failures from a lot of things. And most people would consider these to be excuses. And I say that they're ignorant, you know, in a sense of not knowing. Some are ignorant just in the sense of hating people. But in there, you know, outside of my faith, one of the biggest things, I had two young children at the time because I had my second son, Taj. And I sat there, told myself, like, this is dehumanizing. This is beneath me. In the sense that, like, the way that you talk to, they tell you when you can come out. We were on restricted movement oftentimes, meaning that if one guard is on the block, you can't come outside, you know, and do anything. So, like, we would only get 15 minutes. A certain amount of inmates got 15 minutes to come out. So you had to wash yourself up real quick. We call that playing the water. You got to play the water real fast. And then you had to run to your phone and burn your 10-minute phone time out so you can talk to your loved one. So, you know, with that being said, you were told when to lock in. You were told when you can come out. You know, the food is horrible, like horrendous.
Is it like that bad?
It is horrendous. Like in the county, man, like here in Philadelphia, man, you had to eat out a rubber tray. Like they put food in like heaters and like, you don't even know what that is. You had one plastic yellow cup and then they give you a plastic spork. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like you literally lived with that. That was your cup. You know what I'm saying? So like, imagine not having like, you know, you don't have, the dish, you don't have dish liquid, right. You know what I'm saying? Wash that cup out. Like, yeah.
Did you get in shape? You look like you're in shape.
No. I ain't in shape right now. I was in shape. I was shaping there. Yeah. I'm a little big up top, but I gotta get rid of the stomach, man. But yeah, man, no, I got in shape for sure. But yeah, man, I mean, again, it's like, and even having to talk to your loved ones on those phones, you miss those moments. You got to say happy birthday on that phone. And you know what I mean? It's like, it's just, again, it's dehumanizing. And I will say that, like, they call them correctional facilities, but those resources to really correct you or build you up aren't in there. So if it wasn't for my faith, if it wasn't for me really taking the time, you know, to correct myself or to be corrected, I'll say, by God, because I don't believe we could just fix ourselves. But to spend that time in there studying, spending time in there pursuing my purpose. And that's what my reverend, what he said, that call, it connected in there. I had peace from that. Like, I mind you, I'm fighting attempted murder charges for 15 to 30s, and I'm fighting a 5 to 10 for a separate armed robbery. So, like, I just was like, God, I get it. Like, I'm here, but you give me the opportunity, like, I'm going to take it and run with it. You know what I'm saying?
So then when you got out, did you swear off whatever the street life told
you? Absolutely. In fact, you know, so when I got off, I was acquitted for the attempted murder, still left with the armed robbery. So my custody level dropped. So they finally was like, you know what? Like, this motion, this rule that was in the courts was like, we have to let him go, because I still had an open case. So it was like, that's how backlogged the court system is. I sat 13 months and didn't have a right to a speedy trial. You know what I'm saying? Like, so sitting on a $500,000 bail. So, like, that's how crazy the system is. But with that being said, so they was like, we'll let him go, but only in a condition of house arrest. They called me, like, considered me some type of menace at the point, but they were like, we'll let him go in a condition of house arrest.
For so how long?
I spent an additional 20 months on pretrial house arrest. So I lost almost 3 years of my life.
How often could you leave your home or not at all?
First year was blackout. Couldn't leave.
You're kidding.
First year was blackout. Couldn't leave.
What'd you do?
Read the Bible, right? Talked to my reverend, and we actually started a prayer line, Bible study, phone call line where people would call, and I was actually put in charge of running it. So that's how I got installed.
So
the ministry.
So you got
that
COVID
way.
Training.
Yeah, yeah, right, like, for sure. Before COVID, pre-COVID.
But you, pre-COVID. Yeah, pre-COVID. But right. You were alone. That's the only difference. Yeah. You didn't have the solidarity.
Man, so it was like, you know, had to make the best of it. And yeah, like, that's what I had to do. But first year was blackout, and it was crazy because I had to get a lawyer to even get me out to allow the church. And it was just like, I remember it vividly. The judge was like, we'll give him, you know, time to get out of the church, but he certainly can't go to no night services. So, dude, I had to pick a church that was close by. Like, it wasn't even like, yo, I can go to my original church. Like, yeah. I had to go to a church because I had to be on house arrest at my mom's house, which was right smack dab in my neighborhood. And I had to walk around the corner, and they gave me like an hour and a half window. So it could be too Baptist-y because, you know, we'd have been all day. But yeah, I had to come right back to the crib. So, like, that literally was like house arrest. And then I was allowed to get out. A friend of mine had a catering company. And I mean... Well, I don't know if it's probably statute of limitations past this, but I may or may not have been there every day, but I got a 12 to 8 p.m. window, a time to be outside. You know what I'm saying? So, like,
I was going to say, I was going to ask you, like, did you break it? But then I realized, we're on air. So, okay. I mean, it's funny because you've obviously done amazing things since, but 3 years of your life lost. When you look back on the 3 years now, are you grateful for it? Are you frustrated still? Does it fuel you?
No fuel from it. That's the greatest experience of my life.
No way.
Greatest experience of my life. You know, I told my church just recently, like, without that, you know, like, God had to do what he had to do to mature me. You know what I'm saying? Like, had I probably would have gotten the platform I have today and, you know, amassed the things that I've been able to, you know, amass and do what I do, like, I probably would have squandered it all away.
What would pre-jail you have thought of post-jail you?
Pre-jail me would have thought, like, you know, somebody was pranking me. You know what I'm saying? Like, seriously. I mean, even just with pastoring, like, dude, the last thing I wanted to do was pastor. You know what I'm saying? Like, even the post-jail me. Like, people look at me like some phenomenon because, like, I'm always out in community and I'm always doing so much outside as a pastor, right? Which is kind of like rare in these days, times, you know, day and times, unfortunately. But it's like, I built my bones off of being outside. Right. Like, post-jail me, and when they finally took the ankle monitor off me, funny story, it failed. I had a failure with that ankle monitor while the Bulls were playing the Heat. So this is like how far we're talking about. Derrick Rose was actually Derrick Rose at the moment. Yeah, yeah. He was still Derrick Rose. Like,
Jimmy Butler on the Bulls back then.
Yeah. So this was Bron versus D. Rose.
Yeah.
But, man, it was some type of failure with the house arrest monitor. They call and they're like, where are you? I said, I'm watching a game. I was on the phone with a girl at the time. Wasn't my wife at the time. But I'm on the phone and I'm like, yo, I'm in a house. But you had to have a separate line dedicated for that alone. Like, yeah. Damn. So that phone rings, you know what I'm saying? It's like the red phone. Yeah. So I'm like, yo, what's up? And they're like, yo, man, where are you? I'm like, I'm watching a game.
Yeah.
Call your house arrest officer tomorrow. So I already knew. I was like, yo, they coming to get me. Because I'm like, they don't give you opportunity to wait if they felt like, you know, you played around. They're telling me that so that I don't run. Lo and behold, hour later, they take me back to the county jail. I spent a week there. Literally spent a week. All because they had a malfunction. They let me back home because they knew they had a malfunction. But it was back to the food again. I was like, yo.
Oh, no.
That was like back, the double. Oh, I'm never doing this again.
Oh, no.
Could you watch the playoffs in prison?
No. Like upstate you can, but not in the county. Cause like, again, they control when you coming in and coming out, you know what I'm saying? So like, yeah, like the county is super duper strict, which is where why guys come down from upstate and be like, they got to send me back up top. Like they had court or something. They might send guys from upstate back into the county. Like in the county in Philly is horrible. So they was like, yo, I'm trying to get back up top. That's how much, like when you in those maximum custody county jails, it's like annoying. So like, yeah, but so I wanted to say, but like leaving, you know, so post jail, post, you know, sentencing and everything else, like I hit the ground running. My reverend ended up passing away from lymphoma cancer. Really, really, you know, struck a blow to me. And he was young too, early 30s at the time when he passed away. Yeah, like he had the bone marrow transplant and all, and you know, just came back. So
and he changed your life.
Oh man, changed my life. He said help. He was God used him to save my life for real. I received an award, MLK award, in January, and like I just shouted him out and credited him for that because he definitely listened to God, and that let me know people really hear from God because he did not know me and reached me to say that. So yeah, anyways, when Culture Changing Christians was formed, like everything was outreach. Like I told myself, like, I just want to help, you know, the black community get reconnected to the church. Cause I know that like young millennial black people was very disconnected from the church for various reasons. So like everything we did was outreach. So like I literally ran from pastoring. Multiple churches were trying to, hey, would you come on in and join our pastoral team and all that? I was like, nah, no, not interested. So like, you know, after probably about three different attempts and me consulting with and working with churches to try to help their community engagement, you know, I finally accepted a role. It was all the way in North Jersey. Cause everybody was just like, yo, why you keep saying no? But my mission was like, I don't want to be stuck indoors. And I really felt God pushed in my heart.
You've done enough of that. You did 3 years of that. Yeah.
And it was like, but my heart, God pushed on my heart. It was like, maybe it's up to you to get inside the church and change the culture, you know, from within. So, yeah, that was over 10 years ago. And I was just like, all right, come on, let's go. So, been pastoring ever since, but still do everything that I do outside. So,
can you talk about some of the outreach efforts now and what it's like in North Philly now in some of these neighborhoods?
And by the way, Culture Changing Christians, for the viewers, is your organization.
Yep.
So shout out Culture Changing Christians. But absolutely. Yes.
CCC.
There we go. I like
but,
that.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so our outreach methods and efforts, like, they vary, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, we do work with families, have done interventions with, you know, youth that parents who feel like they're losing their son a bit. Cause you know, parents can notice, you know, that attitude change, behavior change. So like, even when you see the narrative of like, oh, their parents are just letting them do what they want to do. Like, no, you know, their parents are seeing it. Their parents want help out here. And again, that's another thing. Those things don't exist. People don't know how to help a parent, but they're telling people that they're not parenting. And it's not like, you know, you're giving parents the leeway to knock the child upside the head. Like that's illegal now. You know, everything's soft parenting. So you can't do that.
What share of the people that you deal with your outreach work have both a mom and a dad or in the house?
I would probably say roughly maybe 30%. Not a lot. It's not strong. Probably 25-30%. You know what I mean?
What's the difference you notice in people that do and don't have two parents at home?
Man, I would say exposure. You know, a lot of kids who have like two parents in their house has been exposed to much more. And that exposure is crucial because like more you get exposed to, the more innovative, you know, the more hope you have, you know, because you can actually aim higher or look higher. You think the possibilities of things are higher. And, you know, that's where like the trickle down effect. We know that like, you know, mass incarceration, everything else, like or there's so many elements as to why, you know, a father isn't present. Fathers being killed, you know what I mean? A lot of it, you know, its roots are all interconnected. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the things though. Like when we have our young men together, and it's not even to say there's no slam dunk, meaning that that kid won't go ahead and get involved and stuff. Because again, the environment, man, environment swallows you whole, man. Like you'll still, the friends you have nowadays, what we see with violence, the beefs that that starts and how it goes down. It's like, man, you're guilty by association now. You know what I mean? It's the point where you wasn't like 20 years ago.
What do you mean by that?
So like you two are maxes. You know what I'm saying? If you start a beef, you know, somebody else, say you go shoot somebody. Now, even though this max might go ahead and he's just, hey, I'm just a media guy. You know what I mean? I'm not into nothing. Doesn't matter. If we can't find this max, you'll shoot that max.
Gotcha.
And then what they're doing is called upping the score. So they're keeping the score of who kills who, how many, you know what I'm saying? It's like real life Call of Duty out here.
And this plays out on social media?
Plays out on social media for sure. For sure. Cause I mean, the unfortunate part is I don't even understand it myself, but it's like, cause like long time ago, we would have never been trying to publicize anything.
I was gonna say, yeah, you'd think that wouldn't be out there.
It wouldn't be out there, but that's the power of influence though. You know what I'm saying? Like when it's pushed into their subconscious, it's like people again, look at this as excuses, but it's the same reason why we have terms like breeding. There's the same reason why there's like statutory rape. Cause why? Like somebody else is much more advanced in the mind than a minor. You know what I'm saying? Hmm. So this is why, like, if you got a 15-year-old, he's playing violent games, all he's hearing is violent music, all he's seeing is violent stuff on his algorithms, all he sees is violence outside of his community, you know, and his friends now indulge or somehow get ensnared into the violence, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, but Philly, so interestingly, it had it, based on the gun violence numbers, down in 23, down this year, 30% compared to last year. Overdose deaths are way up. I mean, overdose over the last 20 years is way up. Every time we look at overdose statistics, which is often when we try, it's stunning. Yeah. I mean, over 100,000 people died of overdose last year we have data for. So, okay, is Philly heading in the right direction generally where you have gun violence going down even with drug overdose deaths going up, or how do you look at it?
I don't think, you know, so two things, because those issues somewhat coexist but are separate.
Yeah.
Majority of these young guys now are high and getting high when they commit violence.
On what?
You know, man, off a little bit of everything. So when you spoke on my efforts, one of the things that we run as one of our staples is our program Beat the Block. 3 days a week, paid transformative training, holistic training. We believe in building better men and businessmen. That's how we beat the block. That's how we beat the streets. That's how we get you off the block, you know. So I've incentivized young men now, like, listen, I'll replace your drug money and I'll incentivize you through pay if you come spend 4 months with me at a time. We'll help get you employed in 30 days, but then we'll also help build you up into becoming a real man, because we also know systemically there's gaps, there's huge gaps. Mm-hmm. Like this stuff I teach, where I'm like, damn, you should have learned that in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. But we know the schools ain't the schools. And at the same time, their father's not around. So we're teaching them how to be better men because they didn't have the example of men, you know, so, but all while paying them. So these guys make up to $2,000 a month with us, 3 days a week, $500. Spends 5 hours a day. So I tell them all the time, you make it $33.33 an hour.
That's,
and I'm like,
bad.
I'm like, nobody in Philadelphia thinks you're worth $33.33 an hour. But guess what? I do, you know, and we put them on an entire purpose plan. And they leave way better than they came in, you know. And because I got social capital, political capital, a little bit of everything, I bring all kinds of people through those doors so that they can have exposure to. You know what I'm saying? We get them peer-to-peer mentoring in whatever industry they want. So we help them figure that out, you know. But with that being said, they're 18 to 25 years old. So what we hear, and these are guys who come in, battle addiction, been shot before, had cases before, guys who probably shot somebody before. And we have cohorts of 40 of them, you know, at a time. And we hear it. So when you say with drugs, I mean, these guys pop pills, you know what I'm saying? And whether
like
you're talking
opioids
about
and everything.
Zans, you're talking about Suboxins, you talk about, you know, Perks, you talk about, you know, smoking weed, and shoot a lot of time, or sometimes they'll do a concoction of both. You know what I'm saying? So like, even while they're shooting people, like these guys.
What was the zombie drug that Kensington went viral
for? Oh, you talking about Trank?
Yes.
Yeah, Trank. So Trank, yeah, but a lot of these young men aren't using Trank.
Yeah.
But what you'll find in Kensington, and this is why the overdoses are all time high, because think about it, man. You got Trank, you got fentanyl, you got, you know, heroin in its own form. So when these folks now have advanced themselves in an unfortunate way, when we say advanced, but like they've literally, when we say, back in our day when they used to say gateway drug, like the floodgates are open and people are getting high for anything. So like literally, if you walk through Kensington, you'll engage with people, and the trank is like flesh eating. They have open wounds and whatnot because they're consuming this stuff, and it's literally beginning to cause sores, open sores, and everything else on their legs and all kinds of stuff.
What is it? It's a tranquilizer.
Yes, tranquilizer. Yeah. Some variation of horse,
don't like they
horse
spray,
tranquilizer.
Spray. Maybe I'm missing it up.
I don't know how they do that.
I grew
that.
Up in the suburbs.
Yeah,
man.
I don't
know what I'm talking about.
I'm not fond of what they do and how they utilize trank. I can ask.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, man. So it's like, that's why you look up, you got K2, the synthetic marijuana and
that's
everything
what I'm
else.
Thinking. I'm thinking
oh,
of
you
that.
Thinking about
K2? K2.
Yeah. So like that's synthetic that's marijuana thinking, and it's like frying people's brains. Like literally, like, and that's something that young men had access to inside of jails. So like when you didn't have weed, people would access K2. And then also like K2 doesn't even show up in your system. Oh, that was another reason why people was jumping on K2. Wow. Yeah. So people smoke K2, it don't even show up in your system, but it's destroying your brain. I mean, people have lost their entire minds.
So one thing, I mean, if you think of yourself as a 14-year-old today or just the people you work with and help out, it must be really tempting to get on a path of being in the streets, of getting into crime where there's not a lot of opportunity, your friends are doing it, there's a culture, drugs must be tempting. How do you tell someone who's tempted to go down that path to take a better route? That must be tough.
Oh man, it's extremely tough, man. But I mean, I believe this is why we do what we do. You gotta begin to, like, and in this violence prevention space, people typically are always like lauding and applauding what they call the credible messenger, right? Yeah. And they're like, hey, you did jail time, you know, you're black, you're big, you can go down the neighborhood and you can talk to those guys. The problem is these kids don't read history. So like you talk about I did 20 years in this penitentiary. These kids are 17 and got a gun bigger than you. They don't care about that. You know what I'm saying? What you have to do is you have to change the lives of those who are most influential. Huh. We're in a world where people are talking about influence, and influence even impacts everybody 30 plus years old, right? So you got to transform the lives of peers of theirs, and this is what we do. This is what I've done, and I've made it my heart and my life's mission. You know, this is my baby here with Beat the Block, but we go and we get those who have influence, those who are in the mix. And I know this because I get intel from people 30 years and older that's like, yo, I'm like, point me out to some of the guys that really need to be reached and that's really running around and just let me have a conversation. And with that, you change that individual's life.
What do you say in that conversation?
Man, listen, I can start by saying Google me and then from there it's like I can share my journey. Like, yo, I didn't do this by rapping or playing ball or because I'm some skilled musician. Like I'm not a comedian and entertainer. Like I did this because I came through your journey. I come from what you come from. But what I can tell you is if you let me take you in for 4 months, I'll pay you. And guess what? I'll connect you to everything you need in life to really get to everywhere you want to go.
So, okay, it starts, so you kind of think you just got to get them onto something first. You're not just pitching them in a vision and being like, all right, have a good day. It's like leading them along.
Yeah, we're leading them along. You know what I'm saying? And like, we don't lose sight of them either. Like, they continue to follow up. They need other jobs. They need whatever they need. We connect them with. So the thing is, again, if they have the influence, right? Because I need you to understand something. If you got a gang or a crew, and Philly's not really gang-based, but if you got a crew of guys, crew of kids, and like, they're violent, if just 11 of them, 3 of them are really killers. The rest are like, okay, I have to play pretend because like I still got to live in this neighborhood. My family don't have the luxury of just moving out the neighborhood because the neighborhood's bad. You know what I'm saying? Because they move out, they're going to move into another bad neighborhood. Yeah. And if I don't know any of the kids there, it's going to be just as dangerous for me anyway. I have to prove myself in another neighborhood. So we get those who have influence. And again, they become even more influential though now because after 4 months, which isn't a long time, you know, they go back and they're like, because that's part of our program too. We get them to pull up somebody. So see, we reconstruct manhood, fatherhood, brotherhood. So like we close out and say, as a brother, you now have to go reach one of the guys that was right where you was, and you're the proof. Mm-hmm. Like the pastor don't gotta preach. You look at him, look, bro, I'm clean. My appearance is clean. Like I'm like, cause we even work with these guys with hygiene and everything. Yeah. Again, a lot of these young guys really weren't raised by men. So look, brother, I got a job. I make XYZ amount of dollars per hour. I started my business. Here's my LLC. I got a business bank account. Let me pull up my credit app. You know what I'm saying? Like, yo, I built my credit profile up. I did this in 4 months. You know, and if you know, like, and this is them speaking to their own brother. Like, you know me. I was just now at the same crib with you. It was seven
of us. So they know it's achievable. It's not beyond the mountain.
There we go. There we go. So, like, that's why we make it a very, very personal thing. And we make it intentional because y'all have to understand, like, again, if it could be a crew of 11. You really got three guys raising the most hell. And it's probably raising the most hell against the other three guys. And they can shake up an entire zip code. That one beef can shake up an entire zip code and have people scared.
One thing, if you look up, you know, articles about, say, crime in Philly, you'll come up with there's a bunch of stuff always that's like a bus getting shot. Mm-hmm. And that's a very common thing. I get like public transport, right?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I mean, so what you have is you have, for the vast majority of that, man, you know, you may have groups and the most recent stuff been really kids that had problems with each other, you know, at high schools, which is another reason why there's an indicator right there in itself that the parents are involved. Because if a kid knows that he has another problem with some other kids and it could potentially cost him his life, but yet he's still going to school, tells you what? There's a parent at home telling you, yo, you better go to school. You know what I mean? So like knowing your life's at risk, but like, hey, I still got to catch the bus, still got to go to school.
Yeah.
Your mom ain't playing games, but you just ain't telling her what's going on. And these stakes get so high now with these kids, it's just ridiculous. Everything goes to guns. So a lot of times it's those issues. Sometimes it's issues of like people having those disagreements on buses that may be armed and they go straight to the guns. Now one must ask themselves on one end, yes, guns may be too accessible to people, right? And that's like one of the big fights where people got easy access to guns, easy access to guns, easy access to guns. This is America. You have money, you get access to anything. So like that's just one truth. But on the other side of it, it says a lot about where we are culturally and how conflict resolution and everything else is a lost art.
Yeah.
And the fear is so heightened. Yeah. So it's like, yo, of course everybody has a gun in Philadelphia. It's dangerous. You know what I'm saying? So like people get shot in churches, you know, which is why what? Churches have security and whatnot. Yeah. This is America. So with that though, there's another mentality of people where they're like, yo, I got to do something to you before you do something to me.
So you talk about manhood a lot, which is interesting because that's such a hot button topic today. And for example, toxic masculinity, you hear about that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of things that we, you know, uprooted that are good to uproot. But then a lot of people also think, are we not allowed to be straight? It's just things that feel natural and that help out maybe your mom or your sister, or your community, that a lot of those traits that would lead to you contributing are told, you know, like strength and independent, you know, all that. Like, what's your definition of manhood? Like what are you trying to mold these young people into?
So I got a quote that I've coined for my young men. All right. Being a man isn't about being a tough guy, it's about making tough decisions. So, you know, and I live and die by that. You know what I mean? So that just trickles down into any area of life, you know, assessing your circle, knowing and understanding who you need to be around and who you don't need to be around, making a tough decision, you know, sitting there, you know, managing your money and understanding what you should spend, what you shouldn't spend, how to save, how to build discipline within your life and yourself, the tough decision, you know, choosing the right type of woman in your life. You know what I mean? Like she may look good, but may not really be for you. It may, you know, maybe chaotic situation, circumstances, make the tough decision. You know, and so for me, like, that's what a man should do. A man should be willing to make the tough decision, even if it don't feel good at the time. Like,
are there men you encourage them to look up to? Because you bring up rap music and other influences that you said encourage wrong behaviors. Are there some people you're like, look at this person? I mean, you're an example.
Yeah, I'm an example. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really speak to current examples, living examples, you know. My heroes are on my arms. They're dead. So MLK and and Malcolm, the Panthers, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, I do point them to books to read. You know, I mean, I'm heavy on them learning and understanding. The Bible says that we're transformed by the renewing of our minds. And I'm telling them, like, yeah, you have to read. And then y'all need to always have a book around and you know, with you. And continue to read. But I don't really try to pigeonhole them because I would always say to them, like, whatever you want to become in life and what you're really trying to do, I would, you know, advise them to, you know, look at the experts in whatever industry and model that, you know, and never lose your own individual self, but model that and be willing to make the tough choices to get to where you're trying to go.
So, does your work get you any enemies? in the hood?
I mean, it depends on the day, you know, depends on the interview, depend on who I'm with, you know what I'm saying? When I had a town hall with Trump, I don't know, years and years ago when he was on his last campaign, and I had a lot of enemies that, I don't know. It was weird because it was enemies on both sides. I didn't sit there and advocate for Biden last time around, because I was just like, where's the plan? Plan for black folks, black people in my community. So I had Democratic people emailing me, you're really a man of God. You would tell people to go against the evil and make sure, you know what I mean? Then I had Republican folks and folks from Iowa and all the other little middle states and that sent me letters to my church, found where I was at and told me, like, you know, you're talking about racist. You're the one racist. I'm like, wait, is this how it's supposed to work? You know, so like literally, it could be local sometimes. If I oppose certain things that politicians are doing here, you know, they feel a way. You know, community stuff too. You know, if I don't take the right stance where people want me to be at, I work with the Jewish community, some black folks were mad at me. You know what I'm saying? Due to Gaza and Israel and a little bit of everything. So it depends on the day, man. Now, the key question is, do I care? I really don't care. You know, that's the real question. I really don't care.
I love that.
Yeah,
I'm not
the guy they want to take their frustration out on. But I don't really care.
I love that.
You know, I move how I'm supposed to.
So, all right, we're about to head over to Kensington. Excited to see it. And I guess as a final point for a lot of people, because we do have a lot of rural listeners, you know, could you share a little bit about, like, for people who are listening from, say, you know, rural America, they don't know anything about the hood. They don't know a lot about, you know, a lot of people are anti-affirmative action, anti-DEI, and they sort of think it drives race divisions. I mean, what's your general, statement to them?
My statement is to them, read history. That's one. To ask themselves, why was this necessary and needed in the first place? And then after they read history, I would tell them also research the statistics. So there's two elements to it. It needed to be there in place because of the disparities that blacks never had opportunity. Other minorities never had those opportunities allotted and afforded. So they did not have no head start. They didn't even have an even start. But also on the other side, research the statistics. And the reason why I say that is, what they'd come to realize and know is that majority of those things that have been implemented, you know, or presented have not really been implemented. When you look at the stats, you know what I'm saying? Still go look at major corporations, football fans, Rooney Rule. Sounds good in theory, but still a joke. Black man gets an interview just because he's supposed to get an interview. And I'm saying this, if I was white or middle American or whatever I'm supposed to be, why am I offended at all? Well, they interviewing this guy because they just have to give him an interview. You should ask yourself, why do they need to do that? Because we won't pretend as if bias don't exist. Everybody has bias in them, no matter where they're from. You know, black folks have prejudices within them too, you know, even in the place of ignorance. So with that being said, research the stats and ask yourself, you know, did people even act on it? Because people are running with a narrative. And I think that that's their bias is speaking to them right now in that moment. Because then they still realize, wow, those folks, everybody else that doesn't look like me really still needs help because the playing field never got leveled. Never got leveled. A lot of corporations put in these rules, George Floyd protests. Go back and follow up. See where the diversity really is. You'll have two black people on executive board out of 15. You're telling me DEI prevented somebody from what? How much influence do they have? It's one thing to put me at a table. I don't go to tables where my plate is already made for me. You'll never see me there.
Fair. Well, I love it. Well, we're excited to head out. Yeah. Check out Kensington.
Thank you, Pastor. So much.